Hey, it's the takeaway for Tuesday, May 16th, 2017.
This is the second time in a week where senior, respected members of the administration have been asked to walk out on a branch, and then Donald Trump has sawed off the branch.
It's not good for them if your Trump surrogates that were trotted out yesterday to throw shade on the Washington Post story to then have Trump effectively confirm it the next morning.
Other liaison partners also now begin to worry about the security of information they provide the United States because of this, of what's already happened.
And if what's been reported is true, this is a bit of a first for me.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. So reaction there to the Washington Post story yesterday claiming the president handed the Russians free classified information on ISIS. Senior officials, particularly National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, tried to shut down the reaction with a statement yesterday that the president did nothing inappropriate and didn't compromise so-called sources and methods. A strong statement, but it didn't deny what the Post reported. Classified information was told to the Russians, and nothing about sources and methods was mentioned by the Post. This morning, McMaster's very careful, lawyerly statement was seemingly demolished by a tweet from the president. As president, I wanted to share with Russia at an openly scheduled White House meeting, which I have the absolute right to do, facts pertaining to terrorism and airline flight safety. Humanitarian reasons, plus I want Russia to greatly step up their fight against ISIS and terrorism. Was McMaster thrown under the bus? Well, the general stepped to the podium once again today and insisted that all this was no big deal.
I stand by my statement that I made yesterday. And what I'm saying is really the premise of that article is false, that in any way the president had a conversation that was inappropriate or that resulted in any kind of lapse in national security.
So then McMaster was asked if classified information was indeed disclosed.
What we don't do is discuss what is and what wasn't classified. What I will tell you is in the context of that discussion, what the president discussed with the foreign minister was wholly appropriate to that conversation and is consistent with the routine sharing of information between the president and any leaders with whom he's engaged.
We go now to Karen Demirjian, who covers defense and foreign policy for The Washington Post. Karen, I'm having a little difficulty here. How are you doing?
Well, it's coming fast and furious, that's for sure, in addition to the reaction to it all. The National Security Advisor's statement is still interesting. A few hours after the story published, when he spoke publicly, we'd also quoted him in the story, his denials about saying, well, we didn't talk about sources and methods, and there was no information here about any military operations that aren't already public, was not an on-point rebuttal or refutation of anything in the Washington Post report. What we talked about was that Trump seemed to have discussed a codename source and at least identified the city from which the information that this intelligence partner was getting that information, which seems like it would probably be classified information. I mean, you don't have codename sources all the time. You do that when somebody needs to be protected. And that this was information that we hadn't even shared with our allies. So is it possible that we just very intentionally codename source something that is not classified that we then didn't share with our allies that then the president shared with the Russian ambassador and foreign minister that alarmed people enough that we learned of this? I mean, I suppose so. However, it kind of doesn't jive with what seems to make sense, which is that there's something here that is certainly troubling for most other people. On the other part of the advisor's statement, that there was nothing, I believe, inappropriate. I may be misremembering the term that he used, but you know that sort of thing is in the eye of the beholder, and that's exactly what the problem is here. Was it illegal? No, it wasn't. The president has the right to declassify. Usually, it's a slower process that involves consultation with advisors and maybe a heads up to the members of Congress who have the authority to view classified information. But he didn't do anything illegal because he can declassify. The question is, should he have? And was anything done here that was wrong? I think the general backlash to this, the concern, the outrage that you're hearing from many corners of at least the political establishment, including the GOP, suggests that most people don't think it was appropriate or at least seriously questioning whether it was appropriate, despite what McMaster has been saying.
Let's hold on to the appropriate issue for a moment and get to the city issue, because the city issue really relates to how classified information comes in pieces. There's the code name. Then you've got the city. He was asked, McMaster was, about the city, and this is what he said.
It was nothing that you would not know from open source reporting in terms of a source of concern.
Karen Demirjian, is that believable that, hey, you talk about cities all the time?
Yeah, sure, we can talk about cities all the time, but I didn't hear him name a city. If it's that much of a not big deal, why didn't he name the city? We didn't name the city because we thought it was a big enough deal that we wouldn't put it in that report. So, I mean, yes, you can talk about, you know, oh, there's nothing to see here, but he's not actually it's clearly a big enough deal that he's not identifying it himself.
And so I think is he confirming? Is he confirming that in your story?
I mean, this has been an exercise in reading between the lines since the story published. They are not making out and out confirmations, but they are not making on point denials either. And that is the artful political wordplay and needle threading that happens in these situations when you are dealing with information that was not supposed to be disclosed in the first place. You cannot come out and say anything that is going to make you an out-and-out liar, but you cannot come out and confirm stuff that nobody was supposed to have let out of the bag in the first place. So, I mean, I don't envy McMaster right now. He's not in a great situation. It's not an easy sort of thing to resolve, and I believe that probably they put him out there to speak to the press today instead of one of the press secretaries because he's probably the most well-versed in how to use words to get deftly through this situation as closely as possible. But you are not hearing him address things on point, either to say I confirm them or to directly refute and deny them. He's talking about the general tenor of the article or as reported as a whole, which, again, is not going point by point through what was in there, and the point by point of what was in there is what has been so troubling or shocking or whatever adjective you want to use in that spectrum to so many people viewing this, whether it's generally the American public or members of Congress or even, you know, advisors that are closer to the White House.
Karen Demirjian covers defense and foreign policy for The Washington Post. Listen now to former Director of National Intelligence General Michael Hayden.
It's very surprising, and it is damaging. I don't know if I'd call it catastrophic, but it is symptomatic. It's symptomatic of a president who's inexperienced and impulsive and doesn't seem to have any sense of humility in the face of his own inexperience.
The Trump loyalists may be the biggest casualties of this series of events. An intelligence breach, careful, partial denials from senior Trump administration officials, including National Security Advisor General H.R. McMaster, and then the president pulling rank on all of them to say he decides what to talk about when he's in a private meeting with Russian officials. The Russians are not allies, we should point out, and they are under investigation for trying to delegitimize a U.S. election. Here is a quite frankly shocked Jonah Goldberg, senior editor for National Review.
Donald Trump has this gift for, like, I don't know, what do you call those Russian Matryoshka dolls, for taking one firestorm scandal and creating one that's even bigger that envelops and makes us forget the previous one. I mean, yesterday afternoon, everyone was talking about the Comey firing as this incredibly debilitating problem for the White House. And now we have the intelligence leak story. Regardless of how it reflects on his handling of intelligence, I think the real political problem and the problem that he has in terms of how he runs the White House is that this is the second time in a week where senior, respected members of the administration have been asked to walk out on a branch, and then Donald Trump has sawed off the branch. He did it to Mike Pence last week. He did it to his communications team last week with the Comey firing, and he did it to H.R. McMaster last night. And he can't afford to humiliate these people because these people in a lot of ways are the circuit breakers. They're, you know, Donald Trump has fewer reservoirs of trust inside the Republican Party than people realize. But what people do trust are a lot of the people around him. And if he keeps throwing them under the bus, the chaotic nature of this White House is just going to keep compounding and catalyzing. And I don't know where it ends. I have enormous amount of respect for H.R. McMaster. I know people in the military who revere him. He's a straight shooter. He's a serious guy. And I would like to think that he was doing it less to defend Donald Trump, the politician, and more to defend and protect America's interests and national security, because these leaks are a bad thing for American national security, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. Donald Trump has this amazing ability to taint honorable and decent people around him. And that is really dismaying.
Jonah Goldberg, thank you so much.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Jonah Goldberg, senior editor for National Review, columnist for the LA Times, and contributor for Fox News. The value of this shared intelligence is unclear, but it clearly was important enough for the intelligence community to swing into action to control the damage. Listen to Mark Lowenthal, former assistant director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production for the CIA under George W. Bush. He's currently president of the Intelligence and Security Academy. His point is that it makes the credibility of an intelligence operation more suspect and the operation of any intelligence agency much more difficult.
Politicians having braggadocio, there's lots of precedents. A president revealing sensitive liaison intelligence, no, not really.
What swings into action to compensate and try to limit the damage in such an instance?
Well, the horse has left the barn. You know, according to the article, a bunch of White House assistants then immediately called the CIA and NSA and said, we've had an incident here in the Oval Office. And the president said XYZ to Lavrov and Kislyak, because they need to go back to the source, the liaison source, the country that provides, and said, okay, this is what happened. And probably at the same time, they're spending a lot of time assuring other liaison partners, of whom we have dozens and dozens, it's okay, don't worry about it, it's not going to happen again. I mean, the damage is not just to this one relationship with this one source country. The damage is to all of the many, many countries with whom we have foreign liaison relationships. Other liaison partners also now begin to worry about the security of information they provide the United States because of this, of what's already happened. They're going to say, you know, do we really want to share this with the United States? And they can't give information to CIA, for example, and say, now, we're giving you this, but please don't tell the president. You know, that's not going to work. That's not a viable approach. There's a longer-term risk here.
What does this do to the already seemingly compromised relationship between the CIA and the president, and for that matter, the FBI and the president don't seem to be on terribly good terms lately as well?
No, well, I think there are two different sets of problems, the FBI problem versus the CIA problem. You know, the CIA, I mean, the rank and file become more and more wary about dealing with senior officials. Now, that's our job. That's what we do. But if you begin to worry about, gee, can I trust them with this information, that puts sort of a really bad filter on the exchange. And I think, you know, intelligence officers being professionals who try and rise above it, but many of them are going to have in the back of their minds this hesitation, if you will. Now, happily, a lot of the people under him, McMasters, Mattis at Defense, even Tillerson at State, they understand intelligence. They understand what it does, what it doesn't do, how to use it. So that's good. But the trouble is, once you're inside the Oval Office.
Mark Lowenthal is former assistant director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production for the CIA under the George W. Bush administration. Currently, he's president of the Intelligence and Security Academy. Mark, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Bye.
The stalemate or irresponsible government inaction over immigration reform since 1986, that's the last time it succeeded, has produced a number of unintended consequences. First among them are millions of people who crossed the border when they were babies, who are adults or nearly so, and who have only known life in the United States. With an undocumented immigrant population of more than 11 million people right now, any attempt to relocate them becomes a gigantic operation. As part of the deportation process, which ramped up under President Obama, and which President Trump plans to accelerate even more, a shadow prison system for detainees has also grown up. We're going to profile this system this week. People who are picked up by Immigration and Customs Enforcement can wait months, even years in these facilities, often without legal representation or connection to the outside world. On any given day, approximately 34,000 people are held in federally and privately run ICE facilities. Before we hear some harrowing stories of conditions in these facilities later this week, listen to the bizarre tale of how the immigration detention system was born innocently in the mid-20th century, but has become a behemoth, warehousing tens of thousands where the rules are fuzzy and rights can, in practice, be non-existent. Jackie Stevens is professor and the director of Northwestern University's Deportation Research Clinic.
There was no formal detention system to speak of between 1915 and 1984. During that time frame, for the most part, people were held rather informally for short periods of time. And depending on when we're talking about during that time frame, if it was before 1981, there really wouldn't be any detention to speak of. You would just be, you know, if you were ordered removed, released on your own recognizance and either deport yourself or remain in the country without legal authorization. After the private prisons started entering the picture in the 1980s, then you would be in a situation that is pretty similar to what people find themselves in today.
What changed legislatively and then the big change that happened in the 90s?
So in the 1940s, because of the absence of any kind of, you know, institutions for holding people who are in removal proceedings, Congress held hearings in order to decide whether they would give then Immigration and Naturalization Service the authority to hold people. And it was very interesting because a number of civil rights and religious organizations testified during those hearings, and they expressed absolute feelings of being appalled that the United States Congress would even consider holding people, you know, for no reason other than their immigration status. Remember, this is during World War II or in its recent aftermath, and the thought that we would be giving the kind of authority that actually ICE now has was something that just was repellent and didn't pass. And it wasn't until, you know, again, 1952 that then INS first had authority to hold people, and they were so unenthusiastic about that in 1954 they abandoned that authority. And it wasn't until after the arrival of the Haitians and the Cubans in 1980 that there was a revisiting of that policy, and Congress held some hearings, and, you know, actually the first private prison contract by CCA was with INS in 1984.
ICE, of course, is a product of the consolidation of a lot of government agencies into the Department of Homeland Security. Is ICE fundamentally different than the INS, and did ICE begin to do very different things as it looked at detention and the state of immigrants who are caught either with the improper papers or have committed crimes?
Well, as you, I think, were alluding to, and there was a 1996 law that was passed that increased the number of people who would be eligible for deportation. And that was really the turning point in terms of the, you know, the legal basis for people being deported. The numbers jumped from, you know, from 55,000 in 1996 to, you know, over 400,000 and then 425,000 in under the Obama administration. You know, there was that law that was passed under then INS. ICE is formed as an agency, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, emerges as an agency of the Department of Homeland Security, which comes into play in 2003. And there wasn't, you know, any change per se in terms of the operations of the ICE agents. Many of them had come from INS. What really changed in that time frame were the laws and the regulations from the 1990s and the early 2000s that, you know, started snaring more people as unauthorized in the United States.
As this began to scale up, what were the difficulties and what kinds of facilities were commandeered, I guess, to house the growing population?
Right. So, you know, Congress, under the intense lobbying of the private prison industry in the mid-2000s, started questioning whether one of the reasons more people weren't being deported was the lack of facility to house people. There was no evidence that that was the case. However, in 2010, Congress passed a law that required the mandatory detention of no fewer than 34,000 people each night for people who were detained under immigration laws.
I mean, would that mean that if at 5 o'clock in the evening, ICE determines that there are fewer than that quota, do they have to go round up a couple thousand people?
I mean, that would be one fair inference. I mean, presumably the bureaucracy is set up so that they don't have to wait until 5 o'clock in the evening. But the agents, and we know this from documents that are released, are individually incentivized and rewarded based on the number of deportation orders they issue.
Now, what does that mean for an immigrant who is detained? What kind of experience are they going to have? And let's distinguish between people who are held for having problems with their papers and people who are actually held for being arrested for criminal violations.
So nobody who is in custody under immigration laws is there for punishment. You know, the goal of detaining people who are immigrants was laid out in 1915, and it was to provide some kind of hospitable environment for people who were being queried by the United States for the purpose of the benefit of the United States being able to regulate its own borders. However, even though that is, you know, still the law, in practice, the facilities that are holding people for civil detention are literally prisons, and they're run by the prison industry. The people who started the Correctional Corporation of America, and again, you know, the first contract was with INS, came out of the correction industry, the prison industry. And so for no good legal reason, those institutions look exactly like prisons. And the experience, if you are there because you murdered somebody, and then after you served your punishment in a criminal facility, you were transferred to an ICE facility. And the experience, if you're there because you didn't have your driver's license and you were pulled over, is exactly the same. The people are held in exactly the same facilities regardless of their criminal backgrounds.
Are there Miranda rights for people who are picked up for deportation? Do they have their rights read to them? Do they have the opportunity to make a phone call to get a lawyer? Do they have the opportunity for a speedy detention hearing? And if not, they have to be released, these kinds of things.
Right. So the crucial word that you used here is opportunity as opposed to right. So for some of the items that you mentioned, there are, you know, good reasons to believe that they have these rights, including not to provide information that is incriminating. However, in practice, all of the possibilities that you mentioned are deprived to people who encounter, you know, law enforcement agents under immigration laws. So you don't have a right to an attorney if you cannot afford one. You do have a right to appear before some kind of, you know, judicial review in order to have the conditions of your arrest ascertained and, you know, make sure that you're there as the person identified in the arrest warrant and so forth. Based on my research from data made available from the government, it appears that most people are held for less than a month, but, you know, people can be held for 7 years. And many of the cases in which people claim, you know, a legal right to remain in the United States are from people who are long-term legal residents, and they can't fathom being removed to a country in Africa where they haven't been since they were an infant. And so they will remain for years in ICE custody trying to fight those removal orders.
And what kind of treatment will they get in those facilities? Is there standardization? Is it uniform across the country? And are there resources available to make it a different experience than prison?
It's often a worse experience than prison because, as I was mentioning, the legal infrastructure for this is designed for people who are going to be there for a short term. So there's no educational programs. There's no training programs. You asked about the uniformity. Within the private prisons, there is a lot of uniformity. So if you go to a GEO facility in Adelanto, it's going to be pretty similar to one in Aurora, and that's going to be pretty similar to one run by CCA or now CoreCivic in Stuart, Georgia. There is variation depending on the local jails that subcontract and rent space out to ICE. And so, you know, your experience if you're in Arizona in a local jail there might be different from if you're in a local jail in Chicago. But, you know, again, you can tell from the nomenclature that you're in jail or you're in a private prison. And that's not consistent with the intent of civil detention.
Jackie Stevens is a professor and the director of Northwestern University's Deportation Research Clinic. Thanks so much, Jackie.
Thank you.
To the Chinese, today's date marks the official start of the Cultural Revolution. More than a half century ago, in 1966, the government of Mao Zedong issued a document to the Chinese people known as the May 16th Notification, a summary of what would become the ideological justification for the peasant revolution that would last for years and claim millions of lives. The Cultural Revolution is not well known in the West, but it is the defining event of the generations reaching middle age in prosperous China and has echoes in the coming of age of young people as well. We're going to tell you a story now that's very chilling from Hunan Province, less than 200 miles from Mao's hometown, where more than 4,500 people in Daoxian County, many of them children and the elderly, were killed in the fall of 1967. They were killed by each other, friends and neighbors who feared spies and communist backsliders among them. The reason we know anything about Daoxian is because of a brave Chinese journalist by the name of Tan Hecheng, who painstakingly reconstructed what happened for a magazine. And the story he found through voices of residents who agreed to speak was suppressed by that magazine. Tan was eventually able to publish a book of his accounts, banned in China. It was published in Hong Kong and is available in the United States. That book, which is an astonishing contribution to the literature of human rights and their denial, is called The Killing Wind, A Chinese County's Descent into Madness During the Cultural Revolution. And Beijing-based journalist and author Ian Johnson spoke to Tan about his reporting.
The whole issue of memory coming back up to the surface, suppressed facts of the past, that's something that's really intrigued me. So when I heard about this work, I wanted to get in touch with him.
He's not only uncovering something that is of great political significance, but it seems that so he goes at this massacre as a psychological mission, that it really says something about the 20th century, that the Chinese would do this to themselves.
Yeah, I think this is something that he found shocking, a lot of people find shocking, that it was really done to themselves. It was maybe the culmination of almost a century of intense doubt about Chinese culture, Chinese civilization, this feeling that our civilization isn't worth anything. And Mao was the epitome, the culmination of all that. And this violence, this overlay or underlay of violence just came to the fore in the Cultural Revolution. But it had started earlier, this dehumanizing people, saying that these people are not really human. And that's, of course, what makes genocide possible, when you convince one group of people that another group of people are no longer human and that it's okay to kill them.
He sets you in this town and you get the feeling of being there. Describe, from the point of view of what this book tries to achieve, of what it must have been like to have been a person in this town.
Well, one thing that really struck me was when you go there now, of course, there are highways, there's not to mention the internet and all that. But back then when this happened, this was still really poor and rural. And he talks about this being like a plague. And he meant that it spreads when one carrier comes in contact with another person at a walking speed. So somebody had to come from the county seat to a village and instruct the local cadres, the local officials, you've got to kill these people. And it spread out, it radiated like out like that from the center of power in the county out to the villages as party officials walked from one village to another saying, here are the orders, you've got to kill. And often people in the local villages didn't want to kill these people because they were mostly relatives of maybe not immediate relatives but distant relatives. But they said, no, this is your order. You have to kill these people. They are no longer human. They're no longer wanted. They're enemies of the state. We've got to get rid of them once and for all. One person whose story really stuck with me and stuck with Mr. Tan also was Zhou Chun. She had been living in a small town, a village. Her stepfather had been a police officer in the previous regime under the Nationalist Party, and that was enough to get her labeled as an undesirable. So it wasn't anything she had done personally. It was just her stepfather, and he had just been a police officer. She and her husband were rounded up and taken away. And as they were being taken away, the local officials said, don't they have children? They got their three children and herded them all along on almost like a death march, because by at this point these people had been mistreated for weeks and weeks. And they got to these large limestone pits where a lot of the people were killed, and they were just pushed into these pits. They landed on top of other people, and a lot of the people had broken bones and so on. It took them days to die in this pit, and eventually she was rescued, but she had to watch her children die in front of her husband die. And she didn't want to live, of course, afterwards, but she did. And she told us her story. We went and met her, in fact.
Did anyone have a mission, a sense of what we're doing here? Is it make Mao happy? Is it find a utopia? Is it survive?
These people who did a lot of the killing, they were quite young. They were in their 20s. And they had grown up in the Mao era, and they believed that everything Mao said was right. They were the people who had been educated in the Mao time. They may have been born slightly before the communists took over in 1949, but basically they were formed in the Mao years. They believed that Mao was essentially a god. And when he said that there are counter-revolutionary forces who are trying to destroy the revolution, they decided we have to take action. And so they went and decided we have to kill these people. And then, of course, the question is, well, if you kill Mr. X, what about his sons and daughters? Well, they're going to want revenge, so we better kill them also. And what about his brothers and sisters? Better kill them also. So that's why the killing started with just a small group of people and increased. This was something that Tan said over and over again, which struck him when he finally had this moment, this aha moment when he was looking at this. He said to them, was there one person who had agitated against Mao? Was just one person who was trying to start some kind of counter-revolution that could perhaps have justified this? And they said in all of our investigation, and this was a state investigation in the 1980s, they couldn't find one person who had actually done anything. They were just lumped into this group and then killed. And that, I thought, was the most shocking. And for him, this was this moment when he really lost faith in the state and their whole version of history.
Today, do the people of China view the Cultural Revolution as something to just forget completely about, or do they view it as something that could sweep over the country again?
Some people are very nostalgic toward it. They think this was a period of radical egalitarianism. Nowadays, China is one of the most unequal societies in the world. So this period back then was seen as a time when at least we were all equal. And Mao maybe made some mistakes, but he attacked the privileged fat cats in government, the bureaucrats, all the people now who are really corrupt and who lord it over people nowadays. So some people think the Cultural Revolution wasn't bad. And then there are other people like, say, Mr. Tan and people who maybe have a broader view who think the Cultural Revolution won't repeat itself exactly, but this underlay of violence in society is still a problem, that society hasn't found self-correcting mechanisms where problems can be worked out in a peaceful manner. And I think that that's something that a lot of Chinese worry about.
Ian Johnson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ian Johnson is a Beijing-based journalist who spoke to Tan Hicheng about his book, The Killing Wind. Johnson is also an author, most recently, of The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao. She's walked the runways at Fashion Week, graced the cover of the Sports Illustrated swimsuit edition twice, and has been dubbed a supermodel by Vogue. She's also a size 14, close to the average dress size for a woman in the United States, which is a 16. But that's not the average size for most models. Ashley has made a name for herself both with a successful modeling career and as an irresistible advocate for body positivity. She's also collaborated with several designers to create inclusive clothing lines like her Beyond by Ashley Graham with Dress Barn. Ashley just released a memoir called A New Model, What Confidence, Beauty, and Power Really Look Like. She blew into our studios to talk about how her success is a result of smashing your way outside of the box. Thinking outside the box in the fashion industry, she says with a smile, is just not enough.
When you're categorized right away at 12 years old as a plus-size model, you don't really understand the negative connotation that goes with that and that you're going to be brought up in.
12 years old?
12 years old is when I was discovered in a mall, and I was already considered plus-size. Yeah. So I've been told you're the big girl. Even if I already felt it, which I already was, I was already like the big friend. And the people would tell me, oh, you're pretty for a big girl. But then when the fashion industry tells you, oh, no, you are plus-size, then it's like, oh, okay, I've just succumbed to being like, you know, to the outside world as the fat girl, but pretty for the fat girl.
And in the fashion world, it's sort of similar to saying you're like Martian from another planet, that you arrived here with a space suit. I mean, you were on the cover of Vogue, right, with a group of other women.
Yeah, I mean, and that was a yet another monumentous like moment in my career, because never before had they put a curvy model on the cover of Vogue. So thank you, Anna Wintour.
But how did that work? Because you're in a group. I mean, for us, you know, clueless men,
okay,
it's a little bit like, can you find the plus size?
I know. It's really weird. Yeah. So plus size actually technically starts at a size 8. So if you are a woman and you're a size 8 in the fashion world, you're considered plus size. But you won't really work beyond a size 16 because then you're too big. And then the fashion industry doesn't want that in their magazines, catalogs, whatever. So there's a weird line of not being too big, but being not big enough. And then if you're what we call a straight size model, then you're a size 0 to 4, and then you're on the runways. But if you get in that weird place of a 6 to a size 10, you won't work. But now finally people like Gap and Old Navy are using those kinds of women in their, and even Target are using models. Calvin Klein just used their first quote unquote plus size model, and she's like a size 10.
The language, plus,
I know,
curvy, fat, if you're
straight size,
yeah,
all of it.
Right. And as with someone with your notoriety, you also come into collision with a lot of people who find a lot of this language offensive and have political correct alternatives to
100%.
It. 100%. What do you make of them?
I mean, I don't really like labels. It's easier when you're talking about the industry to use them. But if you're going to talk about a female friend, or if you're going to introduce someone, or you don't say, oh, my plus size friend Ashley. You just say, oh, my friend Ashley, she's, you know, tall, beautiful, vivacious, whatever. Because we do not describe men by the number inside of their pants. So I think it's, you know, it's divisive to women when we're only describing them based off of their hip measurement.
Is it hard to shop?
Of course it's hard to shop. Are you kidding? I have to pay for a stylist to like beg designers for clothes. You can't just go into a store as a curvy girl and just buy whatever you want.
Tell the story of
I'm shopping with actually a journalist when we were in London, and she was writing a story on me. And I was like, oh, let's go to this store and I'm going to try on this amazing Balmain dress. And I asked for it in a size 42 because I know a 42 is a size 12 US. Mm-hmm. And I know that they sometimes have really stretchy material. So I knew I could go down a size. It was like feeling good about myself. And I asked the lady working there, can I have a size, you know, 42? And she looked at me, she goes, we don't carry that size. And it was right in front of the journalist, and she saw how this woman totally body shamed me. And I was like, no, I know that Balmain carries a size. Like, I know they even go up to a 46, 48 sometimes. She goes, no. No, we don't. And then someone found out that she had done that to me on the floor, like immediately, and knew that there was a journalist with me and got removed from the floor. And that was one of the first times in a long time that I had gotten body shamed to my face at a retailer. And it was ugly and it was hurtful, but I'm at a point now where I could care less. Like, I'm making, you know, I'm changing lives with my body. My mother even told me, she's like, you are not going to give up on your career, when she said this when I was 17, 18 years old. Your body's going to change someone's life. And sure enough, I've got young girls who come up to me and cry in my arms and say, finally, I feel confident and I've got cellulite and I've got back fat and I know that I'm beautiful.
Romantically, how much has this sort of problem and this weight that the world puts on you and these labels, how much does it affect the way in which you seek, you know, a mate?
Well, I'm married.
Yeah.
7 years in August. But as far as dating when I was younger, that was an issue. I didn't really understand what it was like to have a relationship with a man. And my first boyfriend actually in high school broke up with me because he said, first of all, you're not going to have sex with me, because I was raised in a very Christian home. So he's like, first of all, I'm breaking up with you because you're not going to have sex with me and because I'm afraid you're going to be as fat as my mom. And so then I started correlating the two together, sex and weight. And then as I got older, I knew that my body was being sexualized by men. They saw the boobs, they saw the butt. Because even if you look in magazines, you will see that a curvier woman is always put into the sexier poses, the sexier clothes. So men really started giving me lots of attention. And so I started not liking my body, but men were. So the only way I knew how to have love was through giving my body to men. And it was a very ugly, disgusting cycle that I had to, and it was also food. Then I had this like whole relationship with food. So it was like men, food, weight, oh my God. And then the straw that broke the camel's back was a really terrible, abusive boyfriend. And Even after he chased me around the kitchen with a butcher knife, even after he threw a couch on top of me, I still didn't break up with him because I was so insecure in my body. And it took a friend who really had known me for the last, 5 years, who's my best friend. She said, "You are not the woman that I know. You're not the vivacious, confident woman that moved to New York from Nebraska. This man has really torn something out of you." And after that, I was like, screw this. I'm not having sex till I'm married. And I went the whole other direction. And I'm so glad I did. And I met my husband, and I really found out what it was like to communicate with men, have a relationship with my body, and not have the two overlap all the time. And now I'm happily married for the last 7.5 years.
Do you have a message for the people who are 16? Size?
Size 16 or age?
Yeah, size 16.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, for me, this isn't just about size. I'm not just talking to the curvy girls. I'm not just talking to young girls. I'm talking to anybody who's been told, no, you can't. I'm talking to anybody who feels like they're in a rut and can't get out of it, because I, too, have been in that same situation. It might look a little bit different, but I got out of it, and I made my own way, and I believe that I'm a trailblazer in my industry, and I don't think that anybody who has the drive and determination like I did can't get to where they want to be also.
Ashley, thank you so much. This has been great.
Thank you. Nice to meet you, John.
Nice to meet you. Model Ashley Graham is author of the new book, A New Model, What Confidence, Beauty, and Power Really Look Like. And we want to let you know about a live event we're planning here at WNYC on Tuesday, June 13th. Feminist writer Lindy West is moderating an event called The Other F Word, The Politics of Being Fat. It promises to be a frank and open conversation about how we talk about body image in this country. And if you care about these issues, trust me, you don't want to miss it. You can get tickets online now by visiting thegreenspace.org. That's green with an E. That's all from us today. Quite a journey for a single hour. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Bluevine, offering businesses revolving lines of credit to help them grow and to expand. Credit lines up to $100,000. Small business credit help is available at bluevine.com. LegalZoom.com, helping Americans plan for their family's future with estate plans that include legal guidance provided through LegalZoom's network of independent attorneys. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway. Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or Curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at Curious.com/PRI. Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And Staples, offering tech products, solutions, and services for business like PC setup and repair, data recovery, and virus protection. More at Staples.com/tech services. Staples, it's pro time.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.